This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to the Renegade Report. I'm Jonathan.
And Ramon was just about to have a sip, but Jesus.
A sip. Well, that's interesting. Have you eaten anything delicious lately? Because our countrymen have.
Our countrymen certainly have.
Down in Escort.
They actually dug up bodies that were like a few weeks or months old and ate those too.
I'm not sure how they didn't get like terribly ill from doing that.
Well, you have to be mentally, well, terribly ill to start off thinking that's a good idea, surely.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think you're seriously disturbed if you're eating humans. But we've got people standing outside courts with signs that say no to cannibalism.
#say no to cannibalism. But, I mean, you know, in the end, it's really their culture and our heteronormative Western influence, you know, must be aware of the privilege we have and shouldn't, you know, be too harsh.
We shouldn't judge their culture about eating other humans.
Yeah, not too harshly, because it's their culture and we don't eat humans, so what?
We haven't got that lived experience.
No, we haven't got the lived experience. That's the word I was looking for. Or words.
Oh, man, that's some good stuff right there. Just like apparently human meat is.
So, yeah, so it's 2017. The ANC releases a press statement saying, cannibalism is no good for you. Don't do it. And you got people outside the court saying #say no to cannibalism. Cannibalism.
Yeah, it's great living in Africa, man.
It's
mind blowing. If you are one of our international guests and you think you maybe have warped into another universe, no. People are eating other people in South Africa. That's where we are right now. It's just astonishing. I cannot believe we are here. I just can't.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Do you want to introduce our esteemed guests who we haven't yet eaten?
Right, no, not yet. That's for after the show. So our guest today is I have to say this publicly, I suppose, my best friend. I have to say that. Like, he's someone I know.
I think it's only a fair disclosure.
He's someone I know. Like, he asked me to be his best man. Like, I asked him. We're like, okay, fine, we'll just see each other every few months. And
okay, so there's a bromance talk that's been going on for a long time.
Apparently so. But his name is Sebastian Chatov. And yeah, we've been friends for, 12 years? And he was living in the Soviet Union. And that's why he's here. Welcome, Sebastian.
Well, thank you for having me here, really. I must say it's very good to be here. You must not be doing too well if you have me on your show, really, given what illustrious company you had here before. Yeah. I feel a bit awkward in this chair.
I mean, the previous 12 guests in front of you like couldn't make it or declined or the studio wasn't available, so yeah. We had to go for sloppy seconds. But
we got some Russian, basically. Just like out of the woodwork.
He's not even a Russian.
Well, we're going to get to that.
Right.
So, but nevertheless, one who is willing to question the gastronomic habits of cannibals.
Well, I mean, in Soviet Union, it was fairly normal in Ukraine in the 30s or so, wasn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, there was a famine, and certainly you could buy in the market various human parts if you wanted to.
Well, there are famous photos of people selling like human appendages and heads. In the market in the Ukraine.
And limbs, yes. Yeah. And yes, and people did get eaten. I'm afraid this is what certain policies can lead to.
Well, where are you from, actually, originally?
So, originally born in Bulgaria of mixed Polish and Turkish heritage, and grew up in Russia and went to school there. I still remember Russia when it was a Soviet Union. So my memories go back a bit further than perhaps yours.
Well, you're way older than us, so I would hope so.
Is he really? I think I'm approaching him. I know his age now.
He just look youthful because I age well.
Damn Europeans! All right, so you lived in essentially communist Russia. Is that a fair statement?
You could say that my childhood and my teenage years were certainly spent in that sort of, should we say, Eastern Bloc and immediately post-Soviet environment. So I suppose I have pretty decent recollections of it and pretty decent memories.
So tell us some of those recollections. Tell us some of the more disturbing things that you recall. And oh well, if there were good things, throw them in as well.
Well, not disturbing. I mean, just give us a historical context. Your family has been there as well, I assume, for a number of years. And what do you remember?
Well, there was obviously life before communism as well. And in my case particularly, I have the terrible misfortune to have been descendant from landowners. And you will appreciate that somebody who does not like private property and who believes that this is a means of oppression does not like landowners very much. And if you do not like landowners, essentially you want to hurt them and take their stuff. And my great-grandfather was one of those. He was probably, in English terms, something equivalent to a country squire. He did something in connection with the collection of revenue from his district. And essentially, he hunted and he shot. There was a lake and there were woods and there was a house with a big library. And the commies came to power and they said, well, we want to take your land and use it for a collective farm.
When was this? In the 20s?
This was in Bulgaria, this came a bit later. So the Soviet army occupied after the Second World War. So you're talking about the late 40s and the early 50s. And that's where the mass collectivization happened then. And essentially he was told, give us your land. And he said, how about no? And he got taken for questioning. And the third such questioning, he did not survive. The story I know is that he was deposited in front of the house. It was about 11 at night. He did not have a patch of white skin on his body. That's how bruised he was. There was some kind of a old wife remedy that people believed would help, perhaps because everybody was so freaked out, and that is to cut up a beast and to wrap the man up in the hide. Supposedly that would have helped. They did that. It did not help. About 3 a.m, my great-grandfather expired in the hands of my grandmother, who had just married into the family. And then the next few days, the authorities came, and my great-grandmother signed off everything, really, you know, after she had seen all of this. And essentially the land and the property that the family has occupied for generations went for roughly the equivalent of a annual salary of a rural teacher, which you would appreciate in post-war Europe was even less than what it would mean in today's terms. And if that wasn't enough, commies also like to put you in a certain bracket. They want to know exactly where you stand in terms of those who are oppressed. So in terms of ID books, much as there was in South Africa, the system to classify people according to race. In the Eastern Bloc, there was a system to classify them according to their social background. And if your origins were, shall we say, undesirable, roughly the effect was as the one to having a Jewish grandmother during Nazi Germany. Anything could happen, really, depending exactly on sort of on many things like the phase of the moon and the mood of the secret police. Or there was no real consistency, but it could be anything from outright execution to sentencing and an execution by a kangaroo court to perhaps a sentencing and confiscation of property and imprisonment by a kangaroo court, or it could be just confiscation, or it could be some kind of a concentration camps, depending.
But what do you mean by the term undesirable, or the way the state used it at the time? What did it entail?
Well, so it entailed essentially what the Marxists consider their primary chief interest, their occupation, their relationship to the means of production. And if you owned any of the means of production, for example, because you had a business or because you had a factory or because you owned land, then that was already put you in the class of exploiter. And I think Some people could still be convinced that this is a good thing, but the problem is that once you get into the nitty-gritty of defining, you know, who exactly is an undesirable, the definition gets left to party commissars and apparatchiks, and anything could really go, because you could be a large landowner, you could be a mid-sized landowner, which in Russia was called the kulak, and he was essentially the equivalent of a yeoman farmer. You know, he had a little bit of land which he cultivated successfully, and he had a small surplus for the market, but he was by no means, you know, an oppressor, and chances are he had his family work for him mostly, and maybe with the occasional laborer hired. And then there was another definition, the serednyak, who was the slightly lesser kulak, and then there was the real sort of anybody who had anything in excess of 600 square meters, you know, and all these people were liable to get hurt and to have their stuff taken away from them because they were undesirables, you know, and that is just coming to the rural setting. We're not even going into the cities. In St. Petersburg in 1917, when Trotsky was sort of initially very busy rounding everyone up, his henchmen wanted to know, well, what is this thing of bourgeois, you know, whom are we actually rounding up and shooting? And he says, look, let me explain it to you simple. You go into a guy's house, if he has a sofa and two matching armchairs, he's a bourgeois, take him, shoot him.
Simple as that.
There wasn't, although in many ways Marxism is about splitting fine theological hairs, and I do believe that it is in a way a kind of a secular religion, very often its followers take a much more pragmatic and equally basic approach.
Well, and it appears more strident too. I don't know if Marx advocated, you know, violence in overthrowing capitalism. He sort of understood capitalism is necessary in a way, but his followers, the Bolsheviks specifically, created, we had a guest on here last time, Byron McFadden, the commie, the other commie, yeah. And he said, he's a Marxist, and he says, you know, the problem with Marxism is not Marx itself, is that the Bolsheviks appropriated Marxism for themselves. So everyone who wants to be a Marxist in power has to go through what the Bolsheviks implemented first.
Except, just to make a point on that, is that Marx did talk about a workers' revolution. I don't know how you get a revolution without, you know, the assumption that he must have meant a peaceful revolution with no violence is I think, sure, very charitable.
But I doubt he would want governed bureaucrats rounding up people who have matching lounge suites.
Well, this is, to me, whenever I hear those explanations, I would feel perhaps roughly the way a rape victim would feel, the way a rape apologist would go on about this. Oh, look, it wasn't right, but, you know, the actual thing is okay. No, it's not, because if you look at the doctrine, it does foresee a dictatorship of the proletariat. There's no mucking about there. We, by the force of arms, we shall seize the means of production and we shall destroy the bourgeois order. And while we go about it, you know, we are quite committed and we will eliminate all class enemies. And the class enemy is defined rather broadly as roughly everybody who opposes us. You know, anybody who is not for the revolution is a bit like with George W. Bush. You know, you are against, and therefore, you know, you deserve to be, you're back against the wall.
And in a system that outwardly says property rights don't exist, you would wonder how you could possibly get there from a system with property rights without violence.
Well, this is another idiotic thing about Marxism, yes. But, you know, Marxism is full of idiotic things to begin with. You know, one of those is, yes, private property. This is where they'd like to split a fine theological hair. That's one instance. You know, so you are allowed property, but you are allowed what they call personal property.
Oh, yes.
You're not allowed private property, because insofar and property, a personal property rather, becomes private property when it is used to oppress. So if you own a car and you drive yourself to work, you are using your personal property. But if you become an Uber driver, then you are making a profit, and you will appreciate profits are immoral because they are a result of exploitation.
But even in the sense of owning a car, if you own a car and the majority don't own a car and you drive yourself to work, are you not being oppressive to those who don't own a car? And then in that example, that suddenly becomes, not personal property, but private property.
No, because you are not living off the profits of anyone, really. And that's what really matters to Marxists. In Marxist ideology, the worst possible sin that you could do is make a profit. And the way profit is defined is rather broad, as anybody who has learned anything about the labor theory of value will tell you. The essence is if I make a profit of you as my employee, of the fruits of your labor, then I'm exploiting you. And this obviously doesn't take into account that I also take on the liability to pay you your salary, even if my business is not doing well. So I need to be compensated for my risk. It doesn't compensate the fact that we entered into this thing voluntarily, really. It doesn't matter whether as an employer you're a good, bad, or indifferent, whether as a business owner you're a good, a bad, or indifferent. It matters what group you belong to. What demographic do you belong to? What is your personal likes and dislikes is secondary.
All right, so you've told us about your grandfather, your great grandfather. Obviously, they then have to surrender land, as many others do. They are known to be landowners. So, in other words, your grandfather is then in the same class. Your father ends up in the same class, and you end up in the same class, and that means you get treated in a certain way, which results in what practically in the society.
Well, so you see, these things go to stages through stages, depending on what happens, or rather the stage at which the communist revolution is in. So initially, the commies have to take over power and they have to solidify it. So, that is, a very insecure period. And this is where you get Lenin, and this is where you get Stalin, and this is where you get those sorts of lovely characters who will take out anyone really who stands in their way, and this is roughly what my grandfather experienced, not perhaps to the same extent because he wasn't involved that much with things, but he was, for example, forbidden from attending university. He could not complete a degree. That's because he had essentially what in modern terms would be called privilege. And that landowner privilege was meant to stick with you genetically, and therefore you did not need a university education. We had to put somebody else through it. He would be discriminated when it comes to employment opportunities. He would be allowed to have a job as a teacher in a remote rural school. And as soon as he became established, and this is one of the philosophies of communism, is to run you to the ground until you die. So as soon as you become established at a school, then you get moved to another school, because why not? We could still make your life miserable, because you, privileged, excuse my French, scum, is you're not entitled to any benefits. You are meant to die like the miserable bugger you are.
This sounds very familiar.
Are you still talking about the Soviet Union or South Africa? I can't tell the difference sometimes.
Well, look, and to me, this is the eeriest thing, really, sometimes living in this country, okay? So, this is a democracy which has a communist party in power, communist party that wants to contest elections. Its Minister of Trade is a Marxist academic who hasn't created a single ounce of wealth in his life, but he has written lots of Marxist articles, probably, and that's what they do. It is very eerie when there is this presumption of guilt based on belonging to a certain class. Like, you fellas are white, heterosexual, I hope, males.
Well, half white.
That is true.
Are Jews white? I don't know.
Well, I don't know. We're an ethnicity.
And essentially, you have a privilege, which essentially is, how to say it?
It's a set of advantages that society has bequeathed to us.
Yes, and
we happen to be born this way.
It is genetic, and it is your, in Christian terms, your original sin. This is something you were born with, and this,
you can't get rid of it.
You cannot expiate, possibly.
Children will have it.
Yes. It is passed on by through generation. And this is essentially how it works as well under any other crude form of collectivism. I mean, we have seen it with Nazi Germany. We have seen it with South Africa, with apartheid South Africa. We have seen it with the communist Eastern Bloc and elsewhere. You know, we still see it in places like North Korea. So being here today is rather eerie when I hear debates on privilege. This is essentially taken out from the party propagandists' notebook, really. This is instruction manual for in the best KGB tradition. And then I think, but who trained these guys who are now in power? And I was like, well, he's the KGB.
No, that's true. I mean, we tend to forget that, of course. We just see very badly dressed fat people in parliament, but they all who sleep often.
You're talking about Rob Davies during, now.
Yes. There was a beautiful photo of him in the French Minister of Industry. I don't know if you ever seen
this. Yes, I did.
Superb.
Commies have no fashion sense, I can assure you.
No, yeah. Not in the slightest. But they were all KGB trained. I'm noticing a lot of similarities, Sebastian.
It is rather disturbing. So when I hear revolutionary talk, when I hear the talk about the revolution, it makes me very anxious for South Africa, because to me, South Africa is a wonderful country full of wonderful people.
Mm.
However, it seems to have a terrible penchant, what the French would call, for sticking to dated and discredited ideologies when the rest of the world was abandoning racial segregation in the 50s and the 60s, South Africa ratcheted this all up. When the rest of the world abandoned Marxist-Leninist dogma and the whole anti-bourgeois pro-revolution talk, this is now you have ministers in government, you know, you have leaders of parties, you have presidents speaking that language. And it makes me wonder, well, how do you not experience a monstrous cognitive dissonance in your mind? Because essentially you are saying that your kind of collectivism was worse and my kind of collectivism is better. I often have these discussions with unreconstructed Marxists who are typically elderly white people, and they say, well, Marxism was our way to oppose apartheid. And I was like, but if you want to oppose theft, do you really unleash mass murderers? Or do you create a system that deals competently with rape as it does with theft or with murder?
Right. And another argument a lot of these people make is that, no, if there were other people in charge at the time, it would have been a different system entirely. Yeah.
This is my bloody worst.
And Jordan Peterson has this wonderful clip. He was in Harvard. And he says that the complete arrogance of that statement is astounding. Because believe it or not, if we were, okay, maybe not you, but maybe not you either, actually, Sebastian, but if we were in 1930 Germany, we would probably be Nazi prison guards. Not because we're evil, it's because that's the way society works. That's what our job is. It's not it's just an indication that deep down, we have this capacity for evil that people don't want to
I don't think you need to use the Nazi. You don't even have to. It doesn't have to Godwin's law. You can just use South African examples today. If you are an accountant and you work for KPMG and they're doing business for the Guptas, and your job is to go to KPMG and do your job, and you happen to come across some papers for the Guptas, you carry on doing your job. Most people don't go,
really?
Fuck this shit. I quit.
They don't go to like Daily Maverick, Ranjini, come, let's buy your coffee. Do you know all this stuff? Really? So people just do the job. Unbelievable.
No, but it's absolutely true. I want to just sort of pick your brain a little bit, because you often hear things like, well, yes, there was bad stuff that happened in the Soviet Union and in sort of those communist Marxist countries under Stalin. And yes, Stalin was bad in many ways,
but that was Stalinism, not communism.
Well, yes, of course, real communism has never been tried. Real socialism has never been tried. All that nonsense. But there will be other examples pointed to. So they'll say things like, the Soviet Union was a really strong state, you know, and it stood up to the United States, for example, which is something. The literacy rate was really high. And the literacy rate was high. And healthcare, for example, you know, people will point to Cuba these days. You know, Cuba's also one of the last bastions of communism in the world. They'll point to it and go, well, healthcare is really great there. And by certain markers, healthcare is great. Those markers, of course, are very skewed for what you're looking for. But schooling, as an example, people will go, well, you know, a lot of great scientists came out of Russia in the 60s, 70s. And so it couldn't have been all bad. And so, you know, if we'd just taken away the police who shot people, it's actually the way to go.
I have been privy to these arguments, you see, and my point with them has been, firstly, there is no denying things like it was called the liquidation of illiteracy, achieving a very high literacy rate, achieving free primary, secondary, and in most instances, tertiary education. This was one of the advantages. Well, it is subject to the caveat that a lot of this came with indoctrination, because if you have to teach children the alphabet and the first year at school primers, grade ones, learn to construct sentences along the lines of the Soviet constitution is the most just constitution, and the Bulgarian Communist Party is the best friend to the Soviet Communist Party, you kind of get an idea. A second caveat is that commies do not tolerate intellectual competition, as you will have probably experienced with the more radical left-wingers that you would have interviewed by now. So they have absolutely no problem with censoring. So things like Nietzsche would be banned because he was critical of socialism way back in the 19th century. People like Freud would be banned because that's bourgeois science. You know, who needs that? Things like Friedrich Hayek, the famous Austrian economist, would be like. And what happens is that, sure, you have perhaps very competent engineers, you have perhaps excellent mathematicians, but one day when the whole system tumbles down, do you have somebody who can run an economy? And this is where you need to ask yourself the question, why did Russia, for example, go through such horrible economic reforms in the 90s? Well, because very few people had access to that knowledge.
I thought it was the sanctions. I've been reading the wrong history books, man.
Oh, right, of course, yes. I mean,
another excuse given.
The parallels are just astonishing because.
But I wanted to make a point. There's a guy called Yuri Maltsev.
Yeah.
Whom we know, Sebastian. I don't know if you know him. He was Gorbachev's third economic advisor.
Yes, I do.
Right. Yeah. And I don't know if I told the story before, but anyway, he what do you call it? Absconded, escaped.
Jumped ship, he defected.
Defected to Sweden. And he sat down with Colin Powell in 1988 or 89 or somewhere around there. And Colin Powell says, listen, Yuri, the experts in America are saying the Soviet economy is roughly between 60 and 70% of the US one. And Yuri says, no, it's between 6 and 7%. And Colin Powell says, no, but it must be, you know, between the two. He says, yes, it is between 6 and 7%. So even the Americans were like besotted with the propaganda that the Soviet Union is like this great, powerful nation.
I have heard this as well. In the early 90s, the Soviet Union had roughly the GDP of the Netherlands, and it is a problem of measuring it, though, and this because communism does not measure the gross domestic product. It has different economic metrics, and they're very difficult to translate, but it kind of gives you an idea, you know, when it comes again to education and to all these technological advances that people like to bring up. Well, yes, who won the Second World War? And which country's advanced equipment did we manage to nick to rebuild an industry? You know, if Hitler has a rocket program, but Stalin doesn't, and then a few years later, suddenly the Soviet Union are the first people to send a man to space, does that not get you to ask at least some questions. You know, did all of this arise out of nowhere? You know, or
well, exactly the same thing applies to the Americans. The Americans
indeed, yes,
build jet planes essentially off the backs of German scientists.
Very much so. That's how it was. So all these advances, you know, are very difficult to measure. The second thing that I could say, yes, in terms of, for example, healthcare, there was a lot of advancement. I believe it is called primary and preventative healthcare, and those were very advanced. You know, very early, perhaps in the 40s or 50s, things like malaria and tuberculosis were essentially eliminated. You know, it came to me as a big shocker that, you know, in South Africa, as a fairly advanced society, people were still dying of malaria. But that was something that was removed way back.
Hey, we eat people here. Just be careful what you say about us.
And I will question your gastronomic habits.
We're not even from here. Well, I'm not.
Oh, now that we're eating people, you're not from here. I was just saying the parallels. You keep inadvertently drawing parallels between essentially the Soviet Union sort of 50 years back and modern day, because the same thing as you were talking about education, and you were saying, look, there was education, but it was commie education, and you had to toe that line. So you could become an engineer, but you'd have to be an engineer that believed in communism still as a base principle. And the same thing is happening in universities today. So
absolutely. I'm the product of the South African tertiary educational system. I'm a Wits man. And very often it was certainly in law school, there was a high degree of pressure to write something that would appease the lecturer. And the lecturer was typically left-wing. And law school was still a fine example of liberalism. I think those who went to the humanities department and had to do compulsory notes, essays on gender equality or rather critical gender theory.
I need to give an anecdote here, because we went to varsity together, Sebastian, in case you forgot. So he sounds very posh all of a sudden on this podcast, I noticed. He's actually a lot more, less formal. But anyway, so we had to do English, we did law, and then we had to do English literature for some weird reason. I don't know why. No one knows why. So we had to read this book called Sulla. This book called Sulla. So Sulla is, I don't know, I didn't read it, but it was about, it's by an Indian author about an Indian girl of some sort. Sebastian read halfway through it. Then he goes to the lecturer and he's like, you know, Dr. Harris, I think her name was. He's like, you know, Dr. Harris, I read through this book and it's like, it's really shit. Like, it's really fucking awful. She's like, I did my doctorate on that book. And he's like, that's fine, but still really shit though.
Look, I'm glad you reminded me of this.
We failed. No, I didn't fail. Did you fail that?
No, I think I kind of scraped through, but it does remind me of another anecdote. I cannot remember the name of that lecturer, but she was what we would call to them perhaps a very devout third wave feminism, and she gave a very long lecture on why English is a sexist language. Presumably, it was based on a single article. And the single article stated that English is a sexist language because we say the cleaning lady, but we don't say the cleaning lord, for example, and a whole lot of other examples, which obviously can only be explained by sexism. Therefore, English is sexist. And if you disagree, which I did with her after the lectures, she did to me essentially what Brezhnev did to dissidents. He says, essentially, she says, I should have my head checked, because clearly, if I do not agree with that view, it is because my maleness and my personal experiences in history blind me to the greater, higher truth. And
is it called false consciousness?
Well, yes, this is, in fact, again, this is, I'm very glad you brought it up, this false consciousness.
That's why I'm here.
You know, I think this is where...
Find me a reason.
This is essentially two things here. So false consciousness means that if you are a proletarian, you know, if you're working class, in other words, you work for your money, it means that you have to agree with communist doctrine. And if you do not, you clearly don't know what's in your class's interest, even though you might think that social democracy is actually a better solution, you suffer from false consciousness. This is roughly the equivalent of how, for example, a black intellectual who disagrees with the predominant dogma on race would be crucified, as we have had instances. This is very roughly how a woman who disagrees with third wave feminism would be crucified. Checking your privilege is essentially that. It is acknowledge your bias. It acknowledge your false consciousness.
Yeah, but it's so weird. So first of all, okay, so in South Africa, as you know, Sebastian, so we have white supremacy. Okay, we agree whites are supreme. But then they have false consciousness. So they don't know that they don't know. So i.e. they don't know that they're biased. And then they need to go for processing, i.e., you know, go to the Human Rights Commission for saying a bad word, and they send you for processing or something like that.
Re-education,
well, they call it counselling. It's a euphemism now, but they send you for processing to get those evil racist thoughts out of your head, and then you must pay for the pleasure, and you must pay a private organisation called the Foundation for what. Which foundation the Penny Sparrow had to spend?
I can't.
The Contrada Foundation or something, or one of them.
Yeah, another chair.
How can a court dictate that the one who's being prosecuted has to pay a private institution?
But this is the Soviet model, right? So if you said something in the Soviet Union which was out of bounds, you could have been sent to a gulag, or you could have been put to death even.
Yes.
But if they decided to treat you a little bit nicer than that,
or after the gulags, they didn't last the whole way through.
They might have said, look, you've got a psychiatric condition because you can't see that communism is the best communism.
Obviously, if you disagree with such an enlightened and progressive doctrine that wants to make everybody the same, you know, you must clearly be psychologically disturbed, in which case the full advancement, the full nuance of Soviet psychiatry would be unleashed on you. You would be committed to an institution where you will be treated to the latest advances in Soviet psychiatry, which involved essentially a variation of 19th century thinking, such as hot and cold baths and
lobotomy, or that a bit too advanced.
I wouldn't put it past them, although I'm not aware of such examples, but would be solitary confinement. There would be a lot of re-education, which was obviously necessary. There would be a lot of drugging, obviously, because if there's a chemical imbalance in your brain that prevents you from seeing the truth and the light of communism.
I'm sure a lot of woke Twitter would love that to happen to some of us.
Well, woke Twitter wants that to happen all the time, right?
Come on, Kavanagh, for processing.
Well, woke Twitter would love to see you at the Human Rights Commission, where you would be lambasted by a group of intellectuals, followed by you being fined, and then you being told to go and sit in counseling or therapy where they could readjust your thinking because you are yet to embrace your privilege. I mean, where is the difference?
Well, there isn't a difference, and what surprises me is how many people in this country are blasé about this. You know, I actually had to look into this, you know, and because the parallels were too many, you know, the censorship of views, which we do not like, the crude categorization of people, not according to their likes and dislikes or their hopes and dreams, but according to group membership. And this is the Wyszynski doctrine, for those who do not know. Wyszynski was the prosecutor general of the Soviet Union. And his main thesis is, I don't care what the person has done. I will dig into his life and I will find out, what groups did he belong to? What organizations did he support? What did he do? Who are his parents? Whom does he keep company with? And on that basis alone, there was enough to put a conviction together. And people were very legitimately, very really, through the Soviet justice system, justice in inverted commas, were actually processed. And to me, being blasé when you see such disturbing signs in South Africa now, from this intellectual intolerance, from this crude collectivism, from this absolutely zealous faith in doctrine, in this unshakable righteousness that we have the right to remodel the world, even though we didn't ask the people who whom we purport to do this in the name of whether they actually want it. This is something that is highly disturbing, and being blasé about it is to me a very mistaken attitude. You would be like that bloody frog in that proverbial pot of water that is slowly getting boiled. Jews in the 1930s Germany also didn't think that things could turn out wrong, but people don't have faith. Remember, I mentioned my great grandfather. Okay, one of the reasons why he stayed and didn't leave, unlike a lot of people, was because he felt that, well, look, he actually knew a lot of these commies, because in our family we have a very strong liberal tradition, and he believed that it was wrong for them to be prosecuted for their views, as was the case then. And he, because he had certain administrative powers, issued them with certain paperwork that, for example, allowed them to leave the country. So a lot of them went into exile, and he thought, well, I know these chaps, okay, I've done them some favors, and anyway, they can't be that bad, surely. Well, no, they can be, and they will be, because ideology is more important than human lives. And the sooner people accept that, and the sooner people shake off their South African exceptionalism to think that these are places that, I mean, these are things that happen to other people in other places, the sooner they will be able to react.
Well, the German example works. The reality is that the rabbis in Germany, the chief rabbis of the various cities, Berlin and Frankfurt, and Munich. You know, they told their communities, "Don't worry, don't worry. We will be fine. There will be challenging times, and it will be tough. But we will sort it out." And people listen to the leaders in their community very often, which is, you know, fair enough. They tend to place trust in these leaders, and that was the belief. The belief would be that, you know, they wouldn't possibly do all these things that sound like they're threatening to do them.
But they do them, and they do them already, and we already have people who have lost their jobs because they defended free speech. We have people who are not being promoted. We have people who have been hounded down. We have people who have been doxxed, i.e. they've had their they were de-anonymized on the internet. We have people whose books are not being published. If you are a classical liberal or a conservative in current English-speaking academia, for example, you will struggle to publish because you have no right to your views according to that doctrine. And the further you dig into this, the more you start to appreciate the genealogy and what you are dealing with. You know, and from what I could gather at the moment is that when classical Marxism became discredited, and it got discredited for a number of reasons, you know, not just its death toll, but because intellectually you could not defend the things like the labor theory of value, for example, the dictatorship of the proletariat. There was a bunch of German scholars, which are now known as the Frankfurt School. Yes, and they got together and they decided, Marx was really very limiting himself. You know, he should not have just looked at socioeconomic class. He should have looked at race and gender and sexual orientation. And then this thing got exported into the States by those very same German scholars into particularly Ivy League universities. And from then on, we have the current dominant theory known generically as critical theory, but it's a variant where, you know, critical race or critical gender theory, but the analysis is the same. Much as the bourgeoisie by definition oppresses the proletariat, men by definition oppress women, and heterosexual by definition oppress homosexuals. So we should know what we are dealing with. To me, the most surprising thing is when I had a highly intelligent woman like Helen Zille on your show, and I listened to that podcast. She could not recognize this when new chaps, I think, mentioned it, but this is like Marxism. And she says, no, this is not Marxism. Yes, it is not classical Marxism. This is a postmodernist bastardized version of it, but the tactics are the same.
I recently gave a presentation on the problem of social justice, and essentially it's a Venn diagram. If you take postmodernism, Marxism, and critical theory, And the center where they all meet is social justice. It's the social justice we see today. That's what informs all of the social justice movements. And you can see it in anything they do. So the postmodernism helps them to kind of dismiss any real truth in the society. The Marxism is where the so-called equality comes in.
And how to seize power.
Yeah,
and
account for the power.
And the critical theory, well, it just applies. You take the critical theory and you apply it to whatever you want. So if it's race, it'll be race. If it's gender, it'll be gender.
And in the framework of critical theory, Marxism is essentially critical class theory.
Yes, absolutely.
As a subvariant.
The original version.
Right. I mean, because what the Frankfurt School found was that when Marx said, you know, put down your instruments of oppression, i.e. your rakes and your factory tools and whatever, and don't worry too much about your country. All the people that he said that to somehow rose up and went to fight for their country in World War I. So the Frankfurt School said, well, why is that? And I said, because people don't understand economics, so we need to make it personal. The personal must be political. That's where it came from. And all these people, Adorno, Gramsci, I can't remember what the names are, but they were all, like, weirdly enough.
You're talking about Frankfurt School.
Yeah. They're all sons of rich Jewish businessmen.
Well, the reason they went to the United States. So what happened was, in early 30s Germany, they felt that they would be under threat Jews.
They would, yes.
And so they moved the Frankfurt School to Columbia University in the United States. And following the war, they went back to Germany. But by then, they had basically set up in the social science, I use that term very loosely, but in the social science
we
department.
We call it lady sciences.
Social disciplines.
Okay, that's an official complaint, Ramon. they'd set up in the social sciences by then in Columbia and Yale, pretty much across the East Coast. And they spent the next 40 to 60 years just infiltrating every part of the university. And now that's why you may not step onto certain campuses in the United States if you don't think correctly. And look, I mean, you speak about Witz. Witz has been there's a long-standing joke about Witz being Moscow on the hill, because it has always kind of leaned towards communism and Marxism.
Well, look, this is, again, and it touches on something that you mentioned earlier, you know, the massive benefits of communism. These are always propounded by, or expounded rather, by people who never had to live under it, you know. And obviously, I did not. I've had this discussion as well. I did not live under the right kind of communism. Apparently, somehow, no bloody country ever got that thing wrong. How can that be? Well, yes, no, it was the wrong people in charge. And this is, to me, the bloody obnoxiousness and the smug criminality of these types. Because essentially, what you're trying to say is that if you had unlimited state power, the ability to hurt people and take their stuff, if you were absolutely unaccountable to anyone or anything, really, then you would have done it differently. While you had an ideology that empowers you to do it. Somehow, I should have greater faith in you. No! It's not how any of this works.
No, because the Lenin and Trotsky and Stalin and all that were actually like fairly well-educated people I mean, Stalin was almost a priest at one stage.
Yeah, well, look, Lenin was a lawyer, and I believe he had a PhD as well in that. Yeah.
But it's always the educated intellectuals that are the most dangerous.
Well, yes, it is. To me, it actually comes from getting a lot of your knowledge from books and not from the actual world, developing this internal dialogue with yourself and with people who agree with you intellectually. You know, to me, the real validation of such doctrines comes from whether A, they enjoy political support. And if you notice, commies never really win election. They seize power violently because their ideology justifies it.
Well, that's the difference between communism and socialism.
Yes.
Economically, it's the same thing, but one prefers voting or being voted in. Communies are like, no, we're just going to take it by force.
Basically, yes. The few isolated instances where communism has actually taken power by election is where it has married, oddly enough, nationalism. So if you take Tito in Yugoslavia, you know, who led a successful insurgency against the Germans during the Second World War, he did come to power, and I understand the South African Communist Party would be standing for election in the upcoming.
So they claim, yes.
And I would give them a small percentage because the voting system is designed this way to give them a small proportion if you vote on pure proportionality. What to me is the bigger thing is not how people vote with their ballot paper, but how people vote with their feet. And to me, if you have your people for whom you built this utopia on earth, this is the most progressive and enlightened society, they don't want to have any of it, and they look at the first opportunity to exit it. And in fact, you have to close your borders if they decide to cross them, you shoot them. And if they want to leave them lawfully, they have to get from their government a thing called an exit visa, which you may not have heard. But if you wanted to go to Israel, for example, from the Soviet Union, you didn't just need Israeli visa to go there. You needed a Soviet exit visa. Your own government had to permit you to leave the country. Why, if it is such a excellent, this is such a paradise, you know, why do you need to keep people locked in? People are most honest when they vote with their feet. And apart from a few absolutely misguided lefties who, by the way, didn't stay long, like Lee Harvey Oswald, the guy who shot JFK. Mm. You know, he lived in the Soviet Union for a long time. He had a very good deal cut out for him, where he earned about four times the salary of the annual worker, of the Soviet worker, even though it was considerably less than what he was making in the US. You know, he still left. No. You know, I mean, we could obviously speculate on the many of his reasons there, but the fact that there were very few people who really chose that order, and even brothers from Africa,
And the examples continue, though, because you can use the Soviet Union. It's not as if people are boarding boats from Florida to go to Cuba. People are literally getting on planks in Cuba in the hope that they might make it to the United States. This has been going on for a very long time. Now they can get on planes because they've eased some of those restrictions. I imagine that the sort of immigrants that come from Cuba to visit their family, you know, on holiday trips and never go back will probably increase to some extent.
No way. Trump is in power, man.
You know, the whole Mexican argument. Well, why are the Mexicans trying to get over? Well, they're trying to flee something. It's not communism, but they're fleeing a worse environment. They want to go somewhere which has better opportunity. It's 100% correct. People vote with their feet.
Very good. And this is applicable even to brothers from Africa. You know, in the Soviet Union, it was very important to export, should we say, great Russian imperialism, you know, and otherwise known as communism. And communism is first and foremost an imperialist doctrine. You know, I hope everybody appreciates it. You know, and one way, like all kinds of imperialism, it propagates itself is through education indoctrination. In Moscow, for example, there was the famous Patrice Lumumba University, which provided free tertiary education to socialist-minded youth from the Third World. And how many of them do you think stayed behind? Very bloody few. Let's just say Russia doesn't have a large black population. Ask yourself why that is. Why would somebody prefer to become educated in this works paradise and come back to live in Congo, Africa, where there's malaria and perhaps a bit of civil war and perhaps a bit of failing systems everywhere, really? Well, because it's nevertheless better to get paid in dollars
and to be free. I mean, in a sense, a lot of the times when those systems fail in African countries, as an example, because of a failing system and a failing government, it creates freedom very often.
Well, it is, yes, there is obviously freedom, but I would say also it is the opportunity for prosperity, because in the Soviet Union, you hardly had any. So the only people that had any fair shot at it were the absolute superstars. So these would be people like the cosmonauts. This would be people who were heads of very large state-owned enterprises. These would be obviously very high-level apparatchiks, you know, in a communist party system. But essentially, it worked as a form of hereditary nobility. You know, you had to be born into this, and it is very rare that an outsider was ennobled into it. You know, who your father was mattered a lot more. And
for both ways.
For both ways.
So, so if you were an Ori citizen, it's terrible if your father was a landowner. Mm-hmm. But if you are a part of the Apparachik, it's quite cool. Or not that he's a landowner, but that your father was a high-ranking civil servant. So,
absolutely.
So in that case, it's good.
Well, absolutely. So in South Africa, in modern lingo, this would be called struggle credentials. So the strongest sort of claim to communist blue blood or red blood. I don't know if that's that's quite an apt description, but the strongest claim, so communist high aristocracy, where people whose families participated in the actual revolution, they actually overthrew the old order. So essentially, these were the children of executioners. You know, the children of people who ran kangaroo courts, the children of people who ran death squads. Thereafter, if that was not possible, particularly at a national level, it would be desirable to have one or two of those at a national, at a provincial, at a local level. That would be very good if you were one of those underground people who were perhaps, if not participating in the revolution, they were maybe aiding it. You know, maybe they were distributing some paperwork. You know, they were distributing the Iskra newspaper, which was the main publication of the Communist Party. Further down the ranks, you know, you had to have people who were, you know, absolutely rough peasants, absolutely, you know, bare bones, poor proletarians, you know, who the less skilled the better, you know, and they had to have some sort of political consciousness to them. And, you know, after that, it was perhaps without any of that. But if you had somebody, you know, like both your parents had to be working class, because if only one of them was, you know, that's a little, hey, you've got a bit of impure blood. That's like having a one drop of black blood in, I don't know, the US South in the 1850s.
White national,
white and then
nationalist.
Obviously, if your family had any other blood, then I'm sorry, mate, but, you know, there were very many ways from, you know, punitive psychiatry to a death squad.
We're still talking about the Soviet Union. I keep forgetting.
Oh, marvelous.
I see a lot of parallels.
Who do you think is going to win this? Because I get the sense that, you know, at the end of the last century, if you'd gone to someone and gone, who won this century? You know, did kind of capitalism, democracy, those sort of tenets win? And most people would have said agreed absolutely. By then, it was about 10 years earlier, Berlin Wall had come down. The Soviet Union was basically in pieces. Many of those pieces now allying with states like America and the other sort of allies. You would have said that, you know, communism, Marxism, socialism was on its way out. Yes, there were still some parts of the world that were a bit backwards, but really within the next couple of decades, those would probably disappear. And our side, you know, I take it as my side, because that's the side I'd like to see be victorious, at least in some respect, had won. And now we sit in 2017 with, you know, CNN reporting on Antifa as if they are peace through violence. That's right. How CNN reports them.
Virginity through rape.
And the New York Post said communism was not great, but women had better sex. Did you see that? Did you see that article?
I did. And I don't know if you've noticed how it wasn't the Post, it was actually the Times. And the Times has, over the last 2 to 3 months, has actually, I saw a montage, published a whole bunch of pro-communism, pro-socialism pieces in its op-eds. Although the media, I will say, by the time you hear this podcast, is currently backpedaling on the whole Antifa thing, because they've now realized that these guys are pretty much out of control. And the other day they beat up a journalist, so now the journalists are, even though journalists are just like firemen, they're running in fear. So they are backpedaling a bit, but I'm concerned in that there was almost this we rested on our laurels and we thought, all right, we've won, and we've now sitting at a point where I'm not sure who's going to win. In South Africa, we're definitely leaning far more to the communist Marxist winning the battle. If I were to say, in 20 years' time, are we going to have less human rights commissions or more?
Well, look, this is to me what makes me absolutely livid and exceptionally worried, because I have seen two countries, Bulgaria and Russia, go down to communism, you know, and now the third country that I move in, you know, I must be carrying some form of very bad luck. I agree with you. The 90s were full of optimism. You know, I mean, I remember I read Francis Fukuyama, you know, and he said something to that effect, you know, yes, liberal democracy won the day. We believe in social and in economic freedom. You know, the biggest, strongest ideology that opposed it has now, you know, gone. It's gone with the wind. And it was an era for incredible optimism when the Berlin Wall fell down, you know. And I was there, I was in my preteens when I was watching that television, live television, when they were showing those East Germans with massive hammers hammering that wall down, and I felt a massive sense of cathartic relief, you know. And I could see, I could, up until today, when I watch the video on YouTube, it gives me goosebumps because I can relate to how these people felt
and what it meant.
And what it meant. And I would presume the mood would have been quite jubilant in South Africa as well, because I mean, apartheid felt because there was no more commie support for it, you know. Is that not official doctrine? Did you think it was something else?
I'm okay with that.
No, apartheid felt because the West did not need us as a bulwark against commies anymore.
Well,
we weren't strategic, because once the Soviet Union fell, Angola fell, and all these other places fell, and you know, what's the point of funding South Africa now?
You could say that it was a proxy fight for other people,
essentially,
but the people of South Africa benefited from it, and it must have been a fairly joyous mood here. I wasn't here in 93, 94, but you know, most people would have certainly felt optimistic about, hey, look, finally we will have a liberal constitution. Mm. Finally we will have economic prosperity. We're going to have McDonald's. We're going to have Playboy. I mean, imagine that.
I can tell you people were very excited about McDonald's.
Yes.
I was around for the first McDonald's.
I can still see it, how they become excited about Burger King. And yes, I agree with you. I think your analysis about people resting on their laurels was not entirely incorrect. There was a sense of complacency, and I still see it here in South Africa as well. People still think, oh, well, it can't be that bad. I think, to me, also there was a strategic error, because when we defeated right-wing extremism, shall we call it, in the form of Nazism, we had the Nuremberg trials. We roasted these guys over the coals. We had the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We had a whole lot of other lovely goodies, you know, that we thought, you know, this thing is now banished forever. You know, we banned Mein Kampf because we thought, you know what, even with freedom of expression, this is not something that we want. You know, we banned, particularly the Germans did, you know, the wearing of Nazi regalia and the like. But was there a similar process when it came to Marxist-Leninism? Well, no, there wasn't. You know,
because it imploded. It wasn't defeated. It just imploded by itself.
Well,
but that's a point I made two podcasts ago. Nazism is always seen as worse because it was only tried once.
Well, this is to me again, you know, if I were to choose which side to live on again, look, this is like choosing between killing your mother or your sister.
If you had to live in Cuba in 1991 or
Nazi anywhere
Germany
else
in 1942 or before that, I'd rather live in Cuba, mate. I mean, come on.
Yes, because one is peacetime and one is wartime. You know, we can go on about this, but, you know, I don't think we fully, yes, appreciated the dangers of communism because, yes, Nazism was only tried once, and it was tried for a brief time.
I also think that, you know, this is an example of the lesser of two evils, but you don't need to pick evil. So there are two evils. Maybe you can make the argument, as Ramon has made, that communism is the lesser of the evil in compared to Nazism.
Oh, no, that's not my argument at all. Mm. That's what other people's arguments are. And I'm giving you reasons why they have that argument.
Yeah, fine. So even if that is the argument, the bottom line is you've got other options which aren't evil, and therefore you don't have to pick any of the evils. So it doesn't actually matter. We get rid of Nazism, we get rid of communism and Marxism.
Do you actually hang out with people?
What do you mean?
Do you assume they make good choices?
Rational choices.
Like well-developed thinking, critical analysis
yeah.
of their decisions.
Yeah. Look, the death toll certainly of communism was a lot higher, and I think people don't like when that argument comes
up.
No,
they don't.
You know? But we did mention cannibalism, and perhaps listeners might want to know, this is the famine that happened in the Ukraine, which you will appreciate is one of the most fertile soils in the world. It was Russia's granary. It was the main agricultural region. You know, after collectivization policies, the type that killed my great-grandfather, essentially there was nobody to plow the land. There was nobody to plow the field. There was nobody to breed the animals. And depending on who does the counting, but 6, 7, 8 million people died. They died of starvation. And it takes a special kind of twisted mind to defend a system that brings that about. You know, and we are not counting, you know, everybody who was rounding up for opposing collectivization. Yeah. I believe Stalin told Churchill that about 10 million peasants have been dealt with. We're not counting the dead in the civil war that followed the revolution. We're not counting the gulags. We're not counting the cultural revolution in China, because who cares about China, right? There's too many of them, you know. Oh, what's 50 million, you know, when you've got over a billion?
Where they also ate each other, by the way. They in China, under you know, the Great Leap Forward, cannibalism was also practiced, and there were children sold as meat.
I've heard horror stories.
The reference for that is Noam Chomsky, so I'm not even using a right wing reference. So, yeah, I recently heard it said that as bad as Nazism was and the Holocaust, obviously, it's a rounding error on the number of people killed by communism. So you can make the debate, but as I say, for me, it's just going, they're both bad, and we don't have to choose either.
Oh, well, this is again, you know, to me the most striking thing, you know, people became Marxists, they became left-wing radicals because they wanted to fight right-wing radicals. But why do you want either? You know, why not opt for something that is neither and that is more individualist and that seeks to promote the individual?
Because people are fucking stupid. Don't explain this to both of you.
Yes,
I like your hardened cynicism.
You
know, cynicism.
You can just get out of the podcast now, because otherwise, there's no point. Right?
Well, no, I mean, the basic premise is, if you think that your ideas are more important than people, you're a bastard.
Basically,
and you would kill millions of people just for your ideas to come to fruition, or attempt for them to come to fruition. That is despicably evil.
Well, this is what these both sort of right and left-wing radical collectivism are. They are essentially an ideology that seeks to divide humanity, you know, and whether you do it on social class or on pigmentation, the effect is the same. And the effect brings about two categories of people: us, who have all the rights, and them, who don't. And we, by virtue of a semi-holy book, or some sort of scripture, or the demands of history, or the demands of racial purity, have the right to hurt them and to take their stuff, which was entirely the whole point of the exercise. If you remember Aesop, you know, the great Greek fable teller, you know, I'm not sure if I pronounce his name
Aesop
correctly in English, he had a very similar fable about the lamb and the wolf. And the lamb was saying, "What is my sin?" And the wolf said, "Well, your sin is actually that I want to eat you."
Quite.
Should we end it there? Because, well, I think we've spoken about eating each other quite a bit.
So, yes, may as well. I mean, the parallels are there. It's very interesting to note. I mean, we sort of knew, but hopefully our listeners will sort of understand.
The parallels are frightening, if I could reiterate this again. This secular monotheism that has taken on, that tolerates no dissent, that tolerates no disagreement, that is ready and willing and able to confront and to assault those who disagree with it, is a very dangerous ideology indeed. And in whatever guise or variation it comes, be it as a anti-fascism ideology, be it as a plight for equality, we as human beings need to apply our judgment very carefully, because if we don't learn from history, we're bound to repeat it.
Sebastian, thank you for coming. Really appreciate it.
Good to have you, my mate.
It's nice to have someone who isn't only against the ideology, but has actually experienced what it's like to live under
it. We invited someone who had a lived experience.
There you go. There's your lived experience.
How postmodern of us.
Indeed. By the way, does my lived experience allow me to claim communist oppression privilege, perhaps, and to invite me to a high stakes at the new aristocracy that will be forming?
You look very white.
You see, your whiteness overrules anything.
Really, that is the original
sin. White people were never oppressed.
Everything
you know?
Else is expunged.
Yes.
But white people were never oppressed, Sebastian. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yes, exactly. Yes, of course.
This whole podcast has been a waste of time.
I tend to forget, yes. What's a waste of time for us and for your listeners?
If you didn't think it was a waste of time, you can support us on Patreon. We really would appreciate any support you can offer. We are building up to try to do some great things. We've already had an awesome event with Franz Kronier. We'll be having further events in the future and increasing some content as we build up. So you're welcome to go and support us there. If you're unable to do so, please download the show from iTunes or whichever platform you use. And you can find us on Twitter @Renegade_Report, on Facebook, the Renegade Report group, and also the Renegade Report page. On the group, we have good discussions with people like Sebastian about all of these topics and anything you really want to discuss. There's some great stuff happening there. Thank you so much for listening. Catch you next time. Cheers.
This is CliffCentral.com.